with uneven home-scissored bangs. Our teacher, Miss Page, was a small, pinched woman, given to sudden rages and savage thrashings with her ruler. Mom and Dad had already taught me nearly everything Miss Page was teaching the class. Since I wanted the other kids to like me, I didn't raise my hand all the time the way I had in Blythe. Dad accused me of coasting. Sometimes he made me do my arithmetic homework in binary numbers because they said I needed to be challenged. Before class, I'd have to recopy it into Arabic numbers, but one day I didn't have time, so I turn in the assignment in its binary version. "What's this?" Miss Page asked. She pressed her lips together as she studied the circles and lines that covered my paper, then looked up at me suspiciously. "Is this a joke?" I tried to explain to her about binary numbers and how they were the system that computers used and how Dad said they were far superior to other numeric systems. Miss Page stared at me. "It wasn't the assignment," she said impatiently. She made me stay late and redo the homework. I didn't tell Dad, because I knew he'd come to school to debate Miss Page about the virtues of various numeric systems. Lots of other kids lived in our neighborhood, which was known as the Tracks, and after school we all played together. We played red light, green light, tag, football, Red Rover, or nameless games that involved running hard, keeping up with a pack, and not crying if you fell down. All the families who lived around the Tracks were tight on cash. Some were tighter than others, but all of us kids were scrawny and sunburned and wore faded shorts and raggedy shirts and sneakers with holes or no shoes at all. What was most important to us was who ran fastest and whose daddy wasn't a wimp. My dad was not only not a wimp, he came to play with a gang, running alongside us, tossing us up in the air, and wrestling against the entire pack without getting hurt. Kids from the Tracks came knocking at the door, and when I answered, they asked, "Can your dad come out and play?" Lori, Brian, and I, and even Maureen, could go pretty much anywhere and do just about anything we wanted. Mom believed that children shouldn't be burdened with a lot of rules and restrictions. Dad whipped us with his belt, but never out of anger, and only if we backtalked or disobeyed a direct order, which was rare. The only rule was that we had to come home when the streetlights went on. "And use your common sense," Mom said. She felt it was good for kids to do what they wanted because they learned a lot from their mistakes. Mom was not one of those fussy mothers who got upset when you came home dirty or played in the mud or fell and cut yourself. She said people should get things like that out of their systems when they're young. Once an old nail ripped my thigh while I was climbing over a fence at my friend Carla's house. Carla's mother thought I should go to the hospital for stitches and a tetanus shot. "Nothing but a minor flesh wound," Mom declared after studying the deep gash. "People these days run to the hospital every time they skin their knees," she added. "We're becoming a nation of sissies." With that, she sent me back out to play. Some of the rocks I found while I was exploring out in the desert were so beautiful that I could not bear the idea of leaving them there. So I started a collection. Brian helped me with it, and together we found garnets and granite and obsidian and Mexican crazy lace and more turquoise. Dad made necklaces for Mom out of all that turquoise. We discovered large sheets of mica that you could pound into powder and then rub all over your body so you'd shimmer under the Nevada sun, as if you were coated with diamonds. Lots of times Brian and I thought we'd found gold and would stagger home with an entire bucket full of sparkling nuggets. But it was always iron pyrite, fool's gold. Some of it Dad said we should keep because it was especially good quality for fool's gold. My favorite rocks to find were geodes, which Mom said came from the volcanoes that had erupted to form the Tuscarora Mountains millions of years ago during the Miocene period. From the outside, geodes look like boring round rocks. But when you broke them open with a chisel and hammer, the insides were hollow like a cave, and the walls were covered with glittering white quartz crystals or sparkling purple amethysts. I kept my rock collection behind the house, next to Mom's piano, which was getting a little weathered. Lori and Brian and I would use the rocks to decorate the graves of our pets that died, or of the dead animals we found and decided should get a proper burial. I also held rock sales. I didn't have that many customers because I charged hundreds of dollars for a piece of flint. In fact, the only person who ever bought one of my rocks was Dad. He came out behind the house one day with a pocket full of change and was startled when he saw the price tags I taped to each rock. "Honey, your inventory might move a little faster if you dropped your prices." I explained that all my rocks were incredibly valuable, and I'd rather keep them than sell them for less than they were worth. Dad gave me his crooked smile. "Sounds like you thought this through pretty well," he said. He told me he had his heart set on buying a particular piece of rose quartz, but didn't have the $600 I was charging. So I cut the price to $500 and let him have it on credit. Ron and I loved to go to the dump. We looked for treasures among the discarded stoves and refrigerators, the broken furniture and stacks of bald tires. We chased after the desert rats that lived in the wrecked cars or caught tadpoles and frogs in the scum-topped pond. Buzzards circled overhead and the air was filled with dragonflies the size of small birds. There were no trees to speak of in Battle Mountain, but one corner of the dump had huge piles of railroad ties and rotting lumber that were great for climbing and carving your initials on. We called it the woods. Toxic and hazardous waste were stored in another corner of the dump, where you could find old batteries, oil drums, paint cans, and bottles with skulls and crossbones. Brian and I decided some of this stuff would make for a neat scientific experiment, so we filled up a couple of boxes with different bottles and jars and took them to an abandoned shed we named our laboratory. At first, we mixed things together, hoping they would explode, but nothing happened. So I decided we should conduct an experiment to see if any of the stuff was flammable. The next day after school, we came back to the laboratory with a box of Dad's matches. We unscrewed the lids of some of the jars, and I dropped in matches, but still nothing happened. So we mixed up a batch of what Brian called nuclear fuel, pouring different liquids into a can. When I tossed in the match, a cone of flame shot up with a whoosh like a jet afterburner. Brian and I were knocked to our feet. When we stood up, one of the walls was on fire. I yelled to Brian that we had to get out of there, but he was throwing sand at the fire, saying we had to put it out or we'd get in trouble. The flames were spreading toward the door, eating up that dry wood in no time. I kicked out a board in the back wall and squeezed through. When Brian didn't follow, I ran up the street calling for help. I saw Dad walking home from work. We ran back to the shack. Dad kicked in more of the wall and pulled Brian out, coughing. I thought Dad would be furious, but he wasn't. He was sort of quiet. We stood on the street, watching the flames devour the shack. Dad had an arm around each of us. He said it was an incredible coincidence that he happened to be walking by. Then he pointed to the top of the fire, where snapping yellow flames dissolved into an invisible, shimmery heat that made the desert beyond seem to waver like a mirage. Dad told us that zone was known in physics as the boundary between turbulence and order. It's a place where no rules apply, or at least they haven't figured them out yet, he said. You all got a little too close to it today. None of us kids got allowances. When we wanted money, we walked along the roadside picking up beer cans and bottles that we redeemed for 2 cents each. Brian and I also collected scrap metal that we sold to the junk dealer for a penny a pound, 3 cents a pound for copper. After we redeemed the bottles or sold the scrap metal, we walked into town to the drugstore next door to the Owl Club. There were so many rows and rows of delicious candy to choose from that we'd spend an hour trying to decide how to spend the 10 cents we'd each made. We'd pick a piece of candy and then, as we got ready to pay for it, change our minds and pick another piece, until the man who owned the store got mad and told us to stop fingering all his candy and make a purchase and get out. Brian's favorite was the giant sweet tart candies, which he licked until his tongue was so raw it bled. I love chocolate, but it was gone too quickly, so I usually got a sugar daddy, which lasted practically half the day and always had a funny poem printed in pink letters on the stick like, "To keep your feet from falling asleep, wear loud socks. They can't be beat." On our way back from the candy store, Brian and I like to spy on the Green Lantern, a big dark greenhouse with a sagging porch right near the highway. Mom said it was a cat house, but I never saw any cats there. Only women wearing bathing suits or short dresses who sat or lay out on the porch, waving at the cars that drove by. There were Christmas lights over the door all year round, and Mom said that's how you could tell it was a cat house. Cars would stop in front, and men would get out and duck inside. I couldn't figure out what went on at the Green Lantern, and Mom refused to discuss it. She would say only that bad things happened there, which made the Green Lantern a place of irresistible mystery to us. Brian and I would hide behind the sagebrush across the highway, trying to peer inside the front door when someone went in or out, but we could never see what was going on. A couple of times, we sneaked up close and tried to look in the windows, but they were painted black. Once, a woman on the porch saw us in the brush and waved to us, and we ran away shrieking. One day, when Brian and I were hiding in the sagebrush spying, I double-dared him to talk to the woman lying out on the porch. Brian was almost 6 by then, a year younger than me, and he wasn't afraid of anything. He hitched up his pants, handed me his half-eaten sweet tart for safekeeping, walked across the street, and went right up to the woman. She had long black hair. Her eyes were outlined with black mascara, thick as tar, and she wore a short blue dress printed with black flowers. She had been lying on her side on the porch floor, her head propped up on one arm. But when Brian walked up to her, she rolled over on her stomach and rested her chin on her hand. From my hiding place, I could see that Brian was talking with her, but I couldn't hear what they were saying. Then she reached out a hand to Brian. I held my breath to see what this woman who did bad things inside the Green Lantern was going to do to him. She put her hand on his head and ruffled his hair. Grown-up women always did that to Brian because his hair was red and he had freckles. It annoyed him and he usually swatted their hands away, but not this time. Instead, he stayed and talked with the woman for a while. When he came back across the highway, he didn't look scared at all. "What happened?" I asked. "Nothing much," Brian said. "What did you talk about?" "I asked her what goes on inside the Green Lantern," he said.
"Really?"
I was impressed.
"What did she say?"
"Nothing much," he said. "She told me that men came in and the woman there were nice to them." "Oh," I said. "Anything else?" "Nah," Brian said. He started kicking at the dirt like he didn't want to talk about it anymore. "She was kind of nice," he said. After that, Brian waved to the women on the porch of the Green Lantern, and they smiled real big and waved back. But I was still a little afraid of them. Our house in Battle Mountain was filled with animals. They came and went. Stray dogs and cats, their puppies and kittens, non-poisonous snakes and lizards and tortoises we caught in the desert. A coyote that seemed pretty much tame lived with us for a while, and once Dad brought home a wounded buzzard that we named Buster. He was the ugliest pet we ever owned. Whenever we fed Buster scraps of meat, he turned his head sideways and stared at us out of one angry-looking yellow eye. Then he'd scream and frantically flap his good wing. I was secretly glad when his hurt wing healed and he flew away. Every time we saw a buzzard circling overhead, Dad would say he recognized Buster among them and that he was coming back to thank us. But I knew Buster would never even consider returning. That buzzard didn't have an ounce of gratitude in him. We couldn't afford pet food, so the animals had to eat our leftovers, and there usually wasn't much. If they don't like it, they can leave, Mom said. Just because they live here doesn't mean I'm going to wait on them hand and foot. Mom told us we were actually doing the animals a favor by not allowing them to become dependent on us. That way, if we ever had to leave, they'd be able to get by on their own. Mom liked to encourage self-sufficiency in all living creatures. Mom also believed in letting nature take its course. She refused to kill the flies that always filled our house. She said they were nature's food for the birds and lizards. And the birds and lizards were food for the cats. Kill the flies and you starve the cats, she said. Letting the flies live, in her view, was the same as buying cat food, only cheaper. One day I was visiting my friend Carla when I noticed that her house didn't have any flies. I asked her mother why. She pointed toward a shiny gold contraption dangling from the ceiling, which she proudly identified as a shell no-pest strip. She said it could be bought at the filling station and that her family had one in every room. The no-pest strips, she explained, released a poison that killed all the flies. What do your lizards eat? I asked. We don't have any lizards either, she said. I went home and told Mom we needed to get a no-pest strip like Carla's family, but she refused. If it kills the flies, she said, it can't be very good for us. Dad bought a souped-up old Ford Fairlane that winter, and one weekend, when the weather got cold, he announced that we were going swimming at the Hot Pot. The Hot Pot was a natural sulfur spring in the desert north of town, surrounded by craggy rocks and quicksand. The water was warm to the touch and smelled like rotten eggs. It was so full of minerals that rough, chalky incrustations had built up along the edges, like a coral reef. Dad was always saying we should buy the Hot Pot and develop it as a spa. The deeper you went into the water, the hotter it got. It was very deep in the middle. Some people around Battle Mountain said the Hot Pot had no bottom at all, that it went clean through to the center of the earth. A couple of drunks and wild teenagers had drowned there, and people at the Owl Club said when their bodies floated to the surface, they'd been literally boiled. Both Brian and Lori knew how to swim, but I had never learned. Large bodies of water scared me. They seemed unnatural. Oddities in the desert towns where we'd lived. We'd stayed once at a motel with a swimming pool, and I had worked up enough nerve to make my way around the entire length of the pool, clinging to the side. But the Hot Pot didn't have any neat edges like that swimming pool. There was nothing to cling to. I waded in up to my shoulders. The water around my chest was warm, and the rocks I was standing on felt so hot I wanted to keep moving. I looked back at Dad, who watched me, unsmiling. I tried to push out into deeper water, but something held me back. Dad dived in and splashed his way toward me. "You're going to learn to swim today," he said. He put an arm around me, and we started across the water. Dad was dragging me. I felt terrified and clutched his neck so tightly that his skin turned white. "There, that wasn't so bad, was it?" Dad asked when we got to the other side. We started back, and this time, when we got to the middle, Dad pried my fingers from around his neck and pushed me away. My arms flailed around, and I sank into the hot, smelly water. I instinctively breathed in. Water surged into my nose and my mouth and down my throat. My lungs burned. My eyes were open, the sulfur stinging them, but the water was dark and my hair was wrapped around my face and I couldn't see anything. A pair of hands grabbed me around the waist. Dad pulled me into the shallow water. I was spitting and coughing and breathing in uneven choking gasps. "That's okay," Dad said. "Catch your breath." When I recovered, Dad picked me up and heaved me back into the middle of the Hot Pot. "Sink or swim," he called out. For the second time, I sank. The water once more filled my nose and lungs. I kicked and flailed and thrashed my way to the surface, gasping for air, and reached out to Dad. But he pulled back, and I didn't feel his hands around me until I sunk one more time. He did it again and again, until the realization that he was rescuing me only to throw me back into the water took hold. And so, rather than reaching for Dad's hands, I tried to get away from them. I kicked at him and pushed away through the water with my arms, and finally, I was able to propel myself beyond his grasp. "You're doing it, baby," Dad shouted. "You're swimming." I staggered out of the water and sat on the calcified rocks, my chest heaving. Dad came out of the water, too, and tried to hug me, but I wouldn't have anything to do with him or with Mom, who'd been floating on her back as if nothing were happening, or with Brian and Lori, who gathered around and were congratulating me. Dad kept telling me that he loved me, that he would never let me drown, but you can't cling to the side your whole life. That one lesson every parent needs to teach his child is, if you don't want to sink, you better figure out how to swim. What other reason, he asked, would possibly make him do this? Once I got my breath back, I figured he must be right. There was no other way to explain it. Bad news, Lori said one day when I got home from exploring. Dad lost his job. Dad had kept this job for nearly 6 months, longer than any other. I figured we were through with Battle Mountain and that within a few days would be on the move again. I wonder where we'll live next, I said. Lori shook her head. We're staying here, she said. Dad insisted he hadn't exactly lost his job. He had arranged to have himself fired because he wanted to spend more time looking for gold. He had all sorts of plans to make money, she added. Inventions he was working on, odd jobs he had lined up. But for the time being, things might get a little tight around the house. We all have to help out, Lori said. I thought of what I could do to contribute besides collecting bottles and scrap metal. I'll cut the prices on my rocks, I said. Lori paused and looked down. I don't think that will be enough, she said. I guess we can eat less, I said. We have before, Lori said. We did eat less. Once we lost our credit at the commissary, we quickly ran out of food. Sometimes one of Dad's odd jobs would come through, or he'd win some money gambling, and would eat for a few days. Then the money would be gone, and the refrigerator would be empty again. Before, whenever we were out of food, Dad was always there, full of ideas and ingenuity. He'd find a can of tomatoes on the back of a shelf that everyone else had missed, or he'd go off for an hour and come back with an armful of vegetables, never telling us where he got them, and whip up a stew. But now he began disappearing a lot. "Where, Dad?" Maureen asked all the time. She was a year and a half old, and those were almost her first words. He's out finding us food and looking for work, I'd say. But I wondered if he didn't really want to be around us unless he could provide for us. I tried to never complain. If we asked Mom about food, in a casual way because we didn't want to cause any trouble, she'd simply shrug and say she couldn't make something out of nothing. We kids usually kept our hunger to ourselves, but we were always thinking of food and how to get our hands on it. During recess at school, I'd slip back into the classroom and find something in the other kids' lunch bags that wouldn't be missed, a package of crackers, an apple, and I'd gulp it down so quickly I would barely be able to taste it. If I was playing in a friend's yard, I'd ask if I could use the bathroom, and if no one was in the kitchen, I'd grab something out of the refrigerator or cupboard and take it into the bathroom and eat it there, always making a point of flushing the toilet before leaving. Brian was scavenging, too. One day I discovered him upchucking behind our house. I wanted to know how he could be spewing like that when we hadn't eaten in days. He told me he had broken into a neighbor's house and stolen a gallon jar of pickles. The neighbor had caught him, but instead of reporting him to the cops, he made Brian eat the entire jarful as a punishment. I had to swear I wouldn't tell Dad. A couple of months after Dad lost his job, he came home with a bag of groceries, a can of corn, a half gallon of milk, a loaf of bread, 2 tins of deviled ham, a sack of sugar, and a stick of margarine. The can of corn disappeared within minutes. Somebody in the family had stolen it, and no one except the thief knew who. But Dad was too busy making deviled ham sandwiches to launch an investigation. We ate our fill that night, washing down the sandwiches with big glasses of milk. When I got back from school the next day, I found Lori in the kitchen eating something out of a cup with a spoon. I looked in the refrigerator. There was nothing inside but a half-gone stick of margarine. Lori, what are you eating? Margarine, she said. I wrinkled my nose. Really? Yeah, she said. Mix it with sugar. Tastes just like frosting. I made some. It didn't taste like frosting. It was sort of crunchy because the sugar didn't dissolve, and it was greasy and left a filmy coat in my mouth. But I ate it all anyway. When Mom got home that evening, she looked in the refrigerator. What happened to the stick of margarine? She asked. We ate it, I said. Mom got angry. She was saving it, she said, to butter the bread. We already ate all the bread, I said. Mom said she was thinking of baking some bread if a neighbor would loan us some flour. I pointed out that the gas company had turned off our gas. Well, Mom said, we should have saved the margarine just in case the gas gets turned back on. Miracles happen, you know. It was because of my and Lori's selfishness, she said, that if we had any bread, we'd have to eat it without butter. Mom wasn't making any sense to me. I wondered if she had been looking forward to eating the margarine herself. And that made me wonder if she was the one who'd stolen the can of corn the night before, which got me a little mad. It was the only thing to eat in the whole house, I said. Raising my voice, I added, I was hungry. Mom gave me a startled look. I'd broken one of our unspoken rules. We were always supposed to pretend our life was one long and incredibly fun adventure. She raised her hand, and I thought she was going to hit me. But then she sat down at the spool table and rested her head on her arms. Her shoulders started shaking. I went over and touched her arm. Mom, I said. She shook off my hand, and when she raised her head, her face was swollen and red. It's not my fault if you're hungry, she shouted. Don't blame me. Do you think I like living like this? Do you? That night, when Dad came home, he and Mom got into a big fight. Mom was screaming that she was tired of getting all the blame for everything that went wrong. How did this become my problem? She shouted. Why aren't you helping? You spend the whole day at the Owl Club. You act like it's not your responsibility. Dad explained that he was out trying to earn money. He had all sorts of prospects that he was on the brink of realizing. Problem was, he said, he needed cash to make them happen. There was a lot of gold in Battle Mountain, but it was trapped in the ore. It was not like there were gold nuggets lying around for the prospector to sort through. He was perfecting a technique by which gold could be leached out of the rock by processing it with a cyanide solution. But that took money. Dad told Mom she needed to ask her mother for the money to fund the cyanide leaching process he was developing. You want me to beg for my mother again? Mom asked. God damn it, Rosemary. It's not like we're asking for a handout, he yelled. Should be making an investment. Grandma was always lending us money, Mom said, and she was sick of it. Mom told Dad that Grandma had said if we couldn't take care of ourselves, we could go live in Phoenix in her house. Maybe we should, Mom said. That got Dad really angry. Are you saying I can't take care of my own family? Ask them, Mom snapped. We kids were sitting on the old passenger benches. Dad turned to me. I studied the scuff marks on the floor. Their argument continued the next morning. We kids were downstairs lying in our boxes, listening to them fighting upstairs. Mom was carrying on about how things had gotten so desperate around the house that we didn't have anything to eat except margarine. And now that was gone, too. She was sick, she said, of Dad's ridiculous dreams and his stupid plans and his empty promises. I turned to Lori, who was reading a book. Tell them that we like eating margarine, I said. Then maybe they'll stop fighting. Lori shook her head. That'll make Mom think we're taking Dad's side, she said. It would only make it worse. Let them work it out. I knew Lori was right. The only thing to do when Mom and Dad were fighting was to pretend it wasn't happening, or act like it didn't matter. Pretty soon they'd be friends again, kissing and dancing in each other's arms. But this particular argument just would not stop. After going on about the margarine, they started fighting about whether or not some painting Mom had done was ugly. Then they argued about whose fault it was that we lived like we did. Mom told Dad he should get another job. Dad said that if Mom wanted someone in the family to be punching a time clock, then she could get a job. She had a teaching degree, he pointed out. She could work instead of sitting around on her butt all day painting pictures no one ever wanted to buy. Van Gogh didn't sell any paintings either, Mom said. I'm an artist. Fine, Dad said. Then quit your damn belly aching, or go peddle your ass at the Green Lantern. Mom and Dad's shouting was getting so loud that you could hear it throughout the neighborhood. Lori, Brian, and I looked at one another. Brian nodded at the front door, and we all went outside and started making sandcastles for scorpions. We figured that if we were in the yard acting like the fighting was no big deal, maybe the neighbors would feel the same way. But as the screaming continued, neighbors started gathering on the street. Some were simply curious. Moms and dads got into arguments all the time in Battle Mountain, so it didn't seem that big a deal. But this fight was raucous even by local standards, and some people thought they should step in and break it up. I'll let them work out their differences, one of the men said. No one's got a right to interfere. So they leaned back against car fenders and fence posts or sat on pickup tailgates as if they were at a rodeo. Suddenly, one of Mom's oil paintings came flying through an upstairs window. Next came her easel. The crowd below scurried back to avoid getting hit. Then Mom's feet appeared in the window, followed by the rest of her body. She was dangling from the second floor, her legs swinging wildly. Dad was holding her by the arms while she tried to hit him in the face. Help! Mom screamed. He's trying to kill me! God damn it, Rosemary, get back in here, Dad said. Don't hurt her, Lori yelled. Mom was swinging back and forth. Her yellow cotton dress had gotten bunched up around her waist, and the crowd could see her white underwear. They were sort of old and baggy, and I was afraid they might fall off altogether. Some of the grown-ups called out, worried that Mom might fall. But one group of kids thought Mom looked like a chimpanzee swinging from a tree, and they began making monkey noises and scratching their armpits and laughing. Brian's face turned dark, and his fists clenched up. I felt like punching them too, but I pulled Brian back. Mom was thrashing around so hard that her shoes fell off. It looked like she might slip from Dad's grasp or pull him out of the window. Lori turned to Brian and me. Come on. We ran inside and up the stairs and held on to Dad's leg so Mom's weight wouldn't drag him through the window as well. Finally, he pulled Mom back inside. She collapsed onto the floor. He tried to kill me, Mom sobbed. Your father wants to watch me die. I didn't push her, Dad protested. I swear to God I didn't. She jumped. He was standing over Mom, holding out his hands, palms up, pleading his innocence. Lori stroked Mom's hair and dried her tears. Brian leaned against the wall and shook his head. Everything's okay now, I said over and over again. The next morning, instead of sleeping late the way she usually did, Mom got up with us kids and walked over to the Battle Mountain Intermediate School, which was across the street from the Mary S. Black Elementary School. She applied for a job and was hired right away, since she had a degree, and there were never enough teachers in Battle Mountain. The few teachers the town did have were not exactly the pick of the litter, as Dad liked to say, and despite the shortage, one would get fired from time to time. A couple of weeks earlier, Miss Page had gotten the axe when the principal caught her toting a loaded rifle down the school hall. Miss Page said all she wanted to do was motivate her students to do their homework. Lori's teacher had stopped showing up around the same time Miss Page was fired, so Mom was assigned to teach Lori's class. Her students really liked her. She had the same philosophy about educating children that she had about rearing them. She thought rules and discipline held people back and felt the best way to let children fulfill their potential was by providing freedom. She didn't care if her students were late or didn't do their homework. If they wanted to act out, that was fine with her, as long as they didn't hurt anyone else. Mom was all the time hugging her students and letting them know how wonderful and special she thought they were. She'd tell the Mexican kids never to let anyone say they weren't as good as white kids. She'd tell the Navajo and Apache kids they should be proud of their noble Indian heritage. Students who were considered problem kids or mentally slow started doing well. Some followed Mom around like stray dogs. Even though her students liked her, Mom hated teaching. She had to leave Maureen, who was not yet two, with a woman whose drug dealer husband was serving time in the state prison. But what really bothered Mom was that her mother had been a teacher and had pushed Mom into getting a teaching degree so she would have a job to fall back just in case her dreams of becoming an artist didn't pan out. Mom felt Grandma Smith had lacked faith in her artistic talent, and by becoming a teacher now, she was acknowledging that her mother had been right all along. At night, she sulked and muttered under her breath. In the morning, she slept late and pretended to be sick. It was up to Lori, Brian, and me to get her out of bed and to see to it that she was dressed and at school on time. "I'm a grown woman now," Mom said almost every morning. "Why can't I do what I want to do?" "Teaching is rewarding and fun," Lori said. "You'll grow to like it." Part of the problem was that the other teachers and the principal, Miss Beatty, thought Mom was a terrible teacher. They'd stick their heads into her classroom and see the students playing tag and throwing erasers while Mom was up front, spinning like a top and letting pieces of chalk fly from her hands to demonstrate centrifugal force. Miss Beatty, who wore her glasses on a chain around her neck and had her hair done at the beauty parlor over in Winnemucca every week, told Mom she needed to discipline her students. Miss Beatty also told Mom to submit weekly lesson plans, keep her classroom tidy, and grade the homework promptly. But Mom was always getting confused and filling in the wrong dates on the lesson plans or losing the homework. Miss Beatty threatened to fire Mom, so Lori, Brian, and I started helping Mom with her schoolwork. I'd go to her classroom after school and clean her chalkboard, dust her erasers, and pick the paper up off the floor. At night, Lori, Brian, and I went over her students' homework and tests. Mom let us grade papers that had multiple choice, true, false, and fill-in-the-blank answers. Just about anything except essay questions, which she thought she had to evaluate because they could be answered correctly in all sorts of different ways. I liked grading homework. I liked knowing that I could do what grown-ups did for a living. Lori also helped Mom with her lesson plans. She'd make sure Mom filled them in accurately, and she'd correct Mom's spelling and math. "Mom, double L's in Halloween," Lori said, erasing Mom's writing and penciling in the changes. "Double E's as well, and no silent E at the end." Mom marveled at how brilliant Lori was. "Lori gets straight A's," she once told me. "So do I," I said. "Yes, but you have to work for them." Mom was right. Lori was brilliant. I think helping Mom like that was one of Lori's favorite things in the world. She wasn't very athletic and didn't like exploring as much as Brian and I did, but she loved anything having to do with pencil and paper. After Mom and Lori finished the lesson plans, they'd sit around the spool table, sketching each other and cutting out magazine photos of animals and landscapes and people with wrinkled faces and putting them in Mom's folder of potential painting subjects. Lori understood Mom better than anyone. It didn't bother her that when Miss Beattie showed up to observe Mom's class, Mom started yelling at Lori to prove to Miss Beattie that she was capable of disciplining her students. One time, Mom went so far as to order Lori up to the front of the class, where she gave her a whipping with a wooden paddle. "Were you acting up?" I asked Lori when I heard about the whipping. "No," Lori said. "Then why would Mom paddle you?" "She had to punish someone, and she didn't want to upset the other kids," Lori said. Once Mom started teaching, I thought maybe you would be able to buy new clothes, eat cafeteria lunches, and even spring for nifty extras like the class pictures the school took every year. Mom and Dad had never been able to buy the class pictures for us, though a couple of times, Mom secretly snipped a snapshot out of the packet before returning it. Despite Mom's salary, we didn't buy the class pictures that year, or even steal them, but that was probably just as well. Mom had read somewhere that mayonnaise was good for your hair, and the morning the photographer was coming to the school, she slathered a few spoonfuls on mine. She didn't realize that you were supposed to wash out the mayonnaise. And in the picture that year, I was peering out from under one stiff shingle of hair. Still, things did improve. Even though Dad had been fired from the barite mine, we were able to continue living in the depot by paying rent to the mining company, since not a lot of other families were vying for the place. We now had food in the fridge, at least until it got toward the end of the month, when we usually ran out of money because neither Mom nor Dad ever mastered the art of budgeting. But Mom's salary created a whole new set of problems. While Dad liked it that Mom was bringing home a paycheck, he saw himself as the head of the household, and he maintained that money should be turned over to him. It was his responsibility, he'd say, to handle the family finances. And he needed money to fund his gold-leaching research. "The only research you're doing is on the liver's capacity to absorb alcohol," Mom said. Still, she found it hard to straight out defy Dad. For some reason, she didn't have it in her to say no to him. If she tried, he'd argue and wheedle and sulk and bully and plain wear her down. So she resorted to evasive tactics. She'd tell Dad she hadn't cashed her paycheck yet, or she'd pretend she left it at school and hide it until she could sneak off to the bank. Then she'd pretend she lost all the money. Pretty soon, Dad took to showing up at school on payday, waiting outside in the car, and taking us all straight to Winnemucca, where the bank was located, so Mom could cash her paycheck immediately. Dad insisted on escorting Mom into the bank. Mom had us kids come along so she could try to slip some of the cash to us first. Back in the car, Dad would go through Mom's purse and take the money out. On one trip, Mom went into the bank alone because Dad couldn't find a place to park. When she came out, she was missing a sock. "Jeanette, I'm going to give you a sock that I want you to put in a safe place," Mom said when she got in the car. She winked hard at me as she reached inside her bra and pulled out her other sock, knotted in the middle and bulging at the toe. "Hide it where no one can get it, because you know how scarce socks can get in our house." "God damn it, Rosemary," Dad snapped. "Do you think I'm a fucking idiot?" "What?" Mom asked, throwing up her arms in the air. "Am I not allowed to give my daughter a sock?" She winked at me again, just in case I didn't get it. Back in Battle Mountain, Dad insisted we go to the Owl Club to celebrate payday and ordered steaks for all of us. They tasted so good we forgot we were eating a week's worth of groceries. "Hey, Mountain Goat," Dad said at the end of dinner while Mom was putting our table scraps in her purse. "Why don't you let me borrow that sock for a second?" I looked around the table. No one met my eye except Dad, who was grinning like an alligator. I handed over the sock. Mom gave a dramatic sigh of defeat and let her head drop down on the table. To show who was in charge, Dad left the waitress a $10 tip, But on the way out, Mom slipped it into her purse. Soon we were out of money again. When Dad dropped Brian and me off at school, he noticed we weren't carrying any lunch bags. "Where are your lunches?" Dad asked us. We looked at each other and shrugged. "There's no food in the house," Brian said. When he heard that, he acted outraged, as though he'd learned for the first time that his children were going hungry. "Damn it, that Rosemary keeps spending money on art supplies," he muttered, pretending to be talking to himself. Then he declared more loudly, "No child of mine has to go hungry." After he dropped us off, he called after us, "Don't you kids worry about a thing." At lunch, Brian and I sat together in the cafeteria. I was pretending to help him with his homework so that no one would ask us why we weren't eating when Dad appeared in the doorway, carrying a big grocery bag. I saw him scanning the room looking for us. "My young'uns forgot to take their lunch to school today," he announced to the teacher on cafeteria duty as he walked towards us. He set the bag on the table in front of Brian and me and took out a loaf of bread, a whole package of bologna, a jar of mayonnaise, a half-gallon jug of orange juice, 2 apples, a jar of pickles, and 2 candy bars. "Have I ever let you down?" he asked Brian and me, and then he turned and walked away. In a voice so low that Dad didn't hear him, Brian said, "Yes." "Dad has to start carrying his weight," Lori said as she stared at the empty refrigerator. "He does," I said. "He brings in money from odd jobs." "He spends more than he earns on booze," Brian said. He was whittling, the shavings falling to the floor right outside the kitchen where we were standing. Brian had taken to carrying a pocket knife with him at all times, and he often whittled pieces of scrap wood when he was working something out in his head. "It's not all for booze," I said. "Most of it's for research on cyanide leaching." "Dad doesn't need to do research on leaching," Brian said. "He's an expert." He and Lori cracked up. I glared at them. I knew more about Dad's situation than they did because he talked to me more than anyone else in the family. We'd still go demon hunting in the desert together, for old time's sake, since by then I was 7 and too grown up to believe in demons. Dad told me all about his plans and showed me his pages of graphs and calculations and geological charts depicting the layers of sediment where the gold was buried. He told me I was his favorite child, but he made me promise not to tell Lori or Brian or Maureen. It was our secret. "I swear, honey, there are times when I think you're the only one around who still has faith in me," he said. "I don't know what I would do if you ever lost it." I told him I would never lose faith in him. And I promised myself I never would. A few months after Mom had started working as a teacher, Brian and I passed by the Green Lantern. The clouds above the setting sky were streaked scarlet and purple. The temperature was dropping quickly, from searing hot to chilly within a matter of minutes, like it always did in the desert at dusk. A woman with a fringed shawl draped over her shoulders was smoking a cigarette on the Green Lantern's front porch. She waved at Brian, but he didn't wave back. "Yoo-hoo, Brian, it's me, Sugar. Ginger," she called. Brian ignored her. "Who's that?" I asked. "Some friend of Dad's," he said. "She's dumb." "Why is she dumb?" "She doesn't even know all the words in a sad sack comic book," Brian said. He told me that Dad had taken him out for his birthday a while back. In the drugstore, Dad had let Brian pick out whatever present he wanted, so Brian chose a sad sack comic book. Then they went to the Nevada Hotel, which was near the Owl Club, and had a sign outside saying, "Bar, Grill, Clean, Modern." They had dinner with Ginger, who kept laughing and talking real loud and touching both Dad and Brian. Then all three climbed the stairs to one of the hotel rooms. It was a suite with a small front room and a bedroom. Dad and Ginger went into the bedroom while Brian stayed in the front room and read his new comic book. Later, when Dad and Ginger came out, she sat down next to Brian. He didn't look up. He kept staring at the comic book, even though he'd already read it all the way through twice. Ginger declared that she loved Sad Sack. So Dad made Brian give Ginger the comic book, telling him it was the gentlemanly thing to do. "It was mine," Brian said, "and she kept asking me to read the bigger words. She's a grown-up, and she can't even read a comic book." Brian had taken such a powerful dislike to Ginger that I realized she must have done something more than shanghai his comic book. I wondered if he had figured out something about Ginger and the other ladies at the Green Lantern. Maybe he knew why Mom said they were bad. Maybe that was why he was mad. "Did you learn what they do inside the Green Lantern?" I asked. Brian stared off ahead. I tried to see what he was looking at, but there was nothing there except for the Tuscarora Mountains rising up to meet the darkening sky. Then he shook his head. "She makes a lot of money," he said, "and she should buy her own darned comic book." Some people like to make fun of Battle Mountain. A big newspaper out east once held a contest to find the ugliest, most forlorn, most godforsaken town in the whole country, and declared Battle Mountain the winner. The people who lived there didn't hold it in much regard either. They'd point to the big yellow and red sign way up on a pole at the Shell station, the one with the burned-out S, and say with a sort of perverse pride, "Yep, that's where we live. Hell." But I was happy in Battle Mountain. We'd been there for nearly a year, and I considered it home, the first real home I could remember. Dad was on the verge of perfecting his cyanide gold leaching process. Brian and I had the desert. Lori and Mom painted and read together, and Maureen, who had silky white blonde hair and a whole gang of imaginary friends, was happy running around with no diaper on. I thought our days of packing up and driving off in the middle of the night were over. Just after my 8th birthday, Billy Deal and his dad moved into the tracks. Billy was 3 years older than me, tall and skinny with a sandy crew cut and blue eyes. But he wasn't handsome. The thing about Billy was that he had a lopsided head. Bertha Whitefoot, a half-Indian woman who lived in a shack near the depot and kept about 50 dogs fenced in her yard, said it was because Billy's mom hadn't turned him over at all when he was a baby. He just lay there in the same position day in and day out, and the side of his head that was pressed up against the mattress got a little flat. You didn't notice it all that much unless you looked at him straight on. And not a lot of people did, because Billy was always moving around like he was itchy. He kept his Marlboros rolled up in one of his t-shirt sleeves, and he lit his cigarettes with a Zippo lighter stamped with a picture of a naked lady bending over. Billy lived with his dad in a house made of tar paper and corrugated tin, down the tracks from our house. He never mentioned his mom, and made it clear that you weren't supposed to bring her up, so I never knew if she had run off or died. His dad worked at the Barite mine and spent his evenings at the Owl Club, so Billy had a lot of unsupervised time on his hands. Bertha Whitefoot took to calling Billy the devil with a crew cut and the terror of the tracks. She claimed he set fire to a couple of her dogs and skinned some neighborhood cats and strung their naked pink bodies up on a clothesline to make jerky. Billy said Bertha was a big fat liar. I didn't know whom to believe. After all, Billy was a certified J.D., juvenile delinquent. He told us he had spent time in a detention center in Reno for shoplifting and vandalizing cars. Shortly after he moved to the tracks, Billy started following me around. He was always looking at me and telling the other kids he was my boyfriend. "No, he's not," I would yell, though I secretly liked it that he wanted to be. A few months after he'd moved to town, Billy told me he wanted to show me something really funny. "If it's a skinned cat, I don't want to see it," I said. "Nah, it ain't nothing like that," he said. "It's really funny. You'll laugh and laugh. I promise. Unless you're scared. Of course I'm not scared, I said. The funny thing Billy wanted to show me was in his house, which was dark inside and smelled like pee, and was even messier than our house, although in a different way. Our house was filled with stuff. Papers, books, tools, lumber, paintings, art supplies, and statues of Venus de Milo painted all different colors. There was hardly anything in Billy's house. No furniture. Not even wooden spool tables. It had only one room with two mattresses on the floor next to a TV. There was nothing on the walls, not a single painting or drawing. A naked light bulb hung from the ceiling right next to three or four dangling spiral strips of flypaper so thick with flies you couldn't see the sticky yellow surface underneath. Empty beer cans and whiskey bottles and a few half-eaten tins of Vienna sausages littered the floor. On one of the mattresses, Billy's father was snoring unevenly. His mouth hung open, and flies were gathered in the stubble of his beard. A wet stain had darkened his pants nearly to his knees. His zipper was undone, and his gross penis dangled to one side. I stared quietly, then asked, "What's the funny thing?" "Don't you see?" said Billy, pointing at his dad. "He pissed himself." Billy started laughing. I felt my face turning hot. "You're not supposed to laugh at your own father," I said to him. "Ever." "Aw, now don't go and get all high and mighty on me," Billy said. "Don't go and try to pretend you're better than me. 'Cause I know your daddy ain't nothing but a drunk like mine." I hated Billy at that moment. I really did. I thought of telling him about binary numbers and the glass castle and Venus and all the things that made my dad special and completely different from his dad. But I knew Billy wouldn't understand. I started to run out of the house, but then I stopped and turned around. "My daddy is nothing like your daddy," I shouted. "When my daddy passes out, he never pisses himself." At dinner that night, I started telling everyone about Billy Dill's disgusting daddy and the ugly dump they lived in. Mom put down her fork. "Jeanette, I'm disappointed in you," she said. "You should show more compassion." "Why?" I said. "He's bad. He's a J.D. "No child is born a delinquent," Mom said. "They only became that way," she went on, "if nobody loved them when they were kids. Unloved children grow up to become serial murderers or alcoholics." Mom looked pointedly at Dad and then back at me. "She told me I should try to be nicer to Billy. He doesn't have all the advantages you kids do," she said. The next time I saw Billy, I told him I'd be his friend, but not his girlfriend, if he promised not to make fun of anyone's dad. Billy promised. But he kept trying to be my boyfriend. He told me that if I'd be his girlfriend, he would always protect me and make sure nothing bad ever happened to me and buy me expensive presents. If I wouldn't be his girlfriend, he said, I'd be sorry. I told him if he didn't want to be just friends, fine with me. I wasn't scared of him. After about a week, I was hanging out with some other kids from the tracks, watching garbage burn in a big rusty trash can. They were all throwing in pieces of brush to keep the fire going, plus chunks of tire treads, and we cheered at the thick black rubber smoke that made our noses sting as it rolled past us into the air. Billy came up to me and pulled my arm, motioning me away from the other kids. He dug into his pocket and pulled out a turquoise and silver ring. "It's for you," he said. I took it and turned it over in my hand. Mom had a collection of turquoise and silver Indian jewelry that she kept at Grandma's house so Dad wouldn't pawn it. Most of it was antique and very valuable. Some man from a museum in Phoenix kept trying to buy pieces from her. And when we visited Grandma, Mom would let me and Lori put on the heavy necklaces and bracelets and concha belts. Billy's ring looked like one of Mom's. I ran it across my teeth and tongue like Mom had taught me to. I could tell by the slightly bitter taste that it was real silver. "Where'd you get this?" I asked. "It used to be my mom's," Billy said. It sure was a pretty ring. It had a simple thin band.